We're seeing how the Sabbath theme is introduced into the discussion here. We saw that through the use of Genesis 2:2, latter part of Genesis 2:2 in 4:4. Now, we want to look at 4:9. By the way, particularly as I ask you to read my article, you're aware that I'm wearing two hats here, as it were, the exegete and the systematic theologian. And for our work here primarily, your responsibility is to make sure that I have the exegetical hat on firmly and don't get carried away as systematic theologian. That's our primary concern here. Now, what happens in 4:9? Well, the central concept of rest that has been described repeatedly throughout the passage up to this point, multiply, picking up off the psalm material as a katapausis, that comes from Psalm 94:11 in the Septuagint, that the rest previously described as katapausis is here now replaced, is here called a sabbatismos. Sabbatismos. So this is the replacement term. Now this substitution in vocabulary is certainly striking and requires some explanation. I think it's not speculative to say that the substitution is quite deliberate. Obviously, it would be intentional. To what intention, though, is the question. In some sense, the writer is wanting to do something here with that substitution. In fact, there is good reason to suppose that the author has, in fact, coined this term. Because, you search through the extant materials, there is no occurrence of the term coterminous at the same time as earlier than the writing of the book of Hebrews, looking, say, at the situation up to the end of the first century. There is an occurrence in Plutarch, plus a Latin historian or Hellenistic historian, plus or minus AD 50. But that is not at all related to what we have here. And apparently it doesn't appear elsewhere in extant Greek literature until the time of Justin in his Dialogues. By the way, I have not used the Ibicus to search this out. That's something that I've been meaning to do, haven't gotten to, but I think it's really doubtful that will turn up anything that would modify these generalizations. So it's a term that I think we can be fairly comfortable, safe in saying that the writer himself has coined. And it's not too difficult either to hypothesize, suggest how this term comes about. It's formed on the basis of the Septuagint usage of the verb sabbatizo, a verb that you have, for instance, in Exodus 16:30, and then right at the end of 2 Chronicles 36:21, and the verb there has, as you'd see in this context, reference to the system of Sabbath observance. Exodus 16:30 has to do with a weekly Sabbath. The Second Chronicles passage describes the period of 70-year exile as the land being given a Sabbath. So, the noun, as the verb has this reference to Sabbath observance, so the noun will have a correlative, similar reference, so that we would translate it then as Sabbath keeping, or I would think better here, Sabbath rest or Sabbath resting. Sabbath keeping, Sabbath rest or resting. Now, what prompted the writer to introduce this term at this juncture? What are his motives? I think while it may be difficult to answer that question entirely satisfactory or as fully as we would like, it's still the case that the effect, whatever may have been his motives, the effect of his using this term is quite plain. Because what he is doing, surely, is identifying what has been, up to this point, my rest, God's rest. That rest is now identified quite explicitly as Sabbath resting. So that in an explicit fashion, what the writer is doing here, in some way or the other, that's open to being explained surely in different ways, but whatever may be the further lines of explanation to be given, what the writer is doing is tying together the rest that is the central category of the passage with all of its, with all of the sweep that it has through the passage, as we've discussed that. He ties that together, he ties that to the Sabbath, to the institution of the Sabbath and its observance. And you see, that's only reinforced by the fact that in 4:4, he's already brought Genesis 2:2 into the discussion, which is then cited in Exodus 20 as a motive for the fourth commandment, for the Sabbath command. Further, keeping that in mind, that there is this explicit connection then through this vocabulary, this coinage on his part between the rest that is the central category of the passage and the institution of the Sabbath and his observance. We can go on and say that because God's rest, as it is to be entered by believers at the consummation, because that rest is termed a Sabbath resting, it would appear that what is working here for the writer, what he's concerned for, is to pick up on the fact that Sabbath day observance, is related to this eschatological Sabbath rest as an anticipatory sign. Certainly he doesn't say so explicitly, but the clear implication in what the writer is doing here is that the recurring observance of the Sabbath, ongoing Sabbath observance, has its significance as a sign of eschatological rest. The weekly Sabbath is an eschatological sign. By the way, notice then to clear away one misconception, which I think is a wrong-headed handling of this passage. Verse 9, when the writer says, a sabbatismos remains for the people of God. The point of the reference of verse 9 is not to the weekly Sabbath sign, but to the reality that sign in fact points to. I think it just strikes me as a piece of dogmatizing exegesis to conclude that the writer slips in a statement in 4:9 as if he's wanting to argue to say something explicit about weekly Sabbath keeping. That comes in only by inference, but as we saw, by clear inference. In other words, we want to keep this term is another way of describing the rest that is the central category throughout the passage. One further observation here. In view of the fact that the writer's appeal in bringing the Sabbath into the picture is to Genesis 2, what is said there, that God rested on the seventh day, it would appear then to be specifically the seventh day sign. The typology of the weekly Sabbath that is brought into the discussion here comes in by the use of this term sabbatismos. Not simply the Sabbath, all Old Covenant Sabbath keeping, or the whole Old Covenant Sabbath system, but specifically the weekly Sabbath. So, those any questions about 4:9? Yes, go ahead. I mean, these questions inevitably come up. It's how much you can do with the passage. Let me just say this much so far. See, I think what's happening here is that what exegesis must establish, that is, the reference of the sabbatismos, is getting fudged. It's no longer a alternative way of describing the future eschatological rest, but it becomes a more or less explicit, deliberate statement that the fourth commandment remains for the people of God to observe under the new covenant. And I think that's very difficult to try to argue that as the explicit force of 4:9. It just brings into the picture something that's not in the writers. That maybe I should be a more flexible pedagogue or whatever, but I think it'll be maybe a little bit more orderly if we bring those questions up a little bit later on. Okay, now, the central thread through all this discussion exegetically is, or a central exegetical issue is this: is the rest in view in this passage, 3:7 and following, And now, as we've just been seen, most recently described as a Sabbath resting, or a Sabbath, in this passage, is the rest exclusively future, or is it present as well as future? That's one way in which we can identify the basic issue exegetically. And as you've been you can perhaps appreciate, my argument is that in this context, what I've been wanting to point out, that within the terms of the context, particularly the use of the wilderness model, the rest in this passage is exclusively future. It's a not yet eschatological category. It is not in this passage a category of realized eschatology. Put it another way. So, now, as I've, this would bring us to a seventh point. I want to address that basic issue further by considering certain objections that can be raised or have been raised to the position that I've been arguing here, that it's entirely future. And this, again, we'll pick up on the material that I've already written and ask you to read. I don't want to just be repeating that. What I will, in effect, be doing is going through the material that I've asked you to read and just in highlighting several lines of argumentation. But that is the issue, then. Rest in this passage, purely future or present as well as future. Now, there are three basic lines of objection that I want to deal with. The first line of objection appeals to the wider context of the passage. That is, to the framework of Hebrews as a whole, and points out that the writer has a strong realized eschatology. So that the writer can say, for instance, in 12:22, that we have already come, the new covenant people of God have already come to Mount Zion, the heavenly Jerusalem of the future is already present and accessible by believers. And I think the basic line of response that I think needs to be made to that, is this. Certainly there is no doubt whatsoever that the writer has a realized or teaches a realized eschatology. That's announced right from the very opening banner declaration of the document. God has in these last times spoken to us in the Son. The Son then, who is now bound up with his the eschatological speech that has been spoken in the Son, is eschatologically installed as high priest. So there's no question that you can document, and I don't want to yield to anyone, in not documenting the strong, realized eschatological emphasis that there is in the document. The issue is, though, and I think we have to insist on this as a matter of doing proper exegesis, within this passage, within this immediate context, that is 3:7 through 4:13, and the references to rest that we have here, in this passage, is the rest, present as well as future, or exclusively future. I would even go on, and as I've been wanting to argue, of course, I'm saying it's exclusively future. Just to ice this point a little bit further, I would recognize that quite consistent with his overall emphasis and the realized eschatology that he maintains, the writer could have used the vocabulary of rest in a present sense. The writer would certainly agree with Jesus in Matthew 11:28. Come unto me, all who labor and are heavy laden. I will give you rest, as a promise, or as an offer, as an indication of what is being presently offered in the gospel. But again, the issue is, in this passage, is rest in view in that way. So I think that the appeal to the wider context and the undeniable a realized eschatology that the author has really only confuses the issue. We have to remain focused on the passage. Now, a second objection is to draw attention to the tense, the present tense in 4:3. What does 4:3 say? For we, picking up the we from the main verb, for we who have believed, eis erkometho, present tense. We, as the translation would be argued on this appeal, we who have believed are entering into the rest. And the point now would be, not any appeal to the wider context of the document, but right here within our passage, don't we have a very clear indication of the rest being brought into view as present? In fact, an emphatic indication of that. But here again, as we begin to reflect on this objection, give attention to the Greek syntax, principles of regular, if not normative, patterns of syntax, we have to say, first of all, that the present tense form that we have here, the tense form certainly gives a presumption of a present time force. I wouldn't want to question that. But it does no more than that. It does not settle or clinch the issue. The fact that a present tense form is used here. There's a certain presumption, but it doesn't settle it. Because, pull out Burton's moods and tenses or whatever else you continue to use, as you should, to be cutting your syntactical teeth or whatever. And you will see in Burton or other grammatical tools, that the present indicative, and remember that's what we have here, the present indicative can have various forces. Now, I'm not going to develop this discussion as fully as I could in what I've written. I've given a few more indications, but what that points us to the fact to consider, as we must then always in our exegesis, it's considerations that come from the immediate the context, and particularly the immediate context, that are proved decisive in trying to identify what the force of the tense is. And here is, I think, what we have to recognize. A true present is excluded because it would violate the wilderness model that is being used. It would violate the wilderness model in the way that it is being used and employed by the author. That is, his emphasis throughout is that the believer, those that he is addressing, the church, is not at rest, but in the wilderness, and with the rest in view as a goal that takes us beyond the wilderness. Let me just try to wrap up this point, and we'll take a break. So when we keep that model in view, two translations or two ways of construing the present that can be brought out in translation, as I'll do here in just a second, can be offered, and can be offered without, there's not some kind of exegetical forcing here, for which there are plenty of examples. It can be taken as a present for the future. That is, the present being used in such instances to give to accent certainty, the surety of what is going to take place. So you could translate, we will enter. Or perhaps, and if you look in, I won't cite the grammatical discussion of that point. It's in note 28 of the article that would give you some background there. Or it can also be given, the present here can be given a progressive sense, in the sense of we are entering, so that the thought then is of being actually underway toward the rest, but in fact not yet there. And just quoting Funk in his grammar at this point, on this point, verbs of going or coming, such as we have here, also have the meaning of to be in the process of going or coming, for which reaching the destination still lies in the future. And as I recall, I believe that's without reference to this passage, particularly or specifically. That so there's a pattern of other passages.